This is special coverage from WBUR in Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. Tonight, the deep and strained relationship between the United States and Israel. How did these two democracies become entwined? And how will the war on terrorism affect a half century of friendship? First, a nation on high alert. For the second time this month, the FBI yesterday warned Americans of the strong possibility of new terrorist attacks this week. Josh Meyer has been following the investigation for the Los Angeles Times. He joins us from the Times Washington Bureau. Hello, Josh Meyer.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
Well, thanks. Josh, what's the latest information coming out of the White House and FBI about possible terrorist attack this week? Who's talking and what are they saying?
Well, top Justice Department officials and White House administration officials are all saying that they have strong and credible evidence that there are threats, but they don't know where they're coming from. This afternoon, they said that it was a convergence of credible sources. That's what Tom Ridge, the new director of Homeland Security, said, and that they also have reference to violent language that was caught in some intelligence intercepts, but they really don't know where it's coming from, when it's going to happen, or in what form.
So nothing more specific really today than yesterday?
No.
It's a
Not that they're telling us.
It's a fine line here between informing the public and stirring hysteria. Has the administration crossed that line? What's the reaction today in Washington and around the nation?
Well, there's a lot of Congress people and others that are saying that they've crossed the line, that if nothing else, that crying wolf this many times is going to make the public a little bit less reactive the next time that they do really issue a warning. But they say that they thought it out very seriously. They consulted with the president and with many others, and they decided to go forward with the warning to make the public and law enforcement more vigilant. They said that there's really nothing else they can do and that they'll continue to issue such warnings when the threats become available.
And what's your sense from watching, Josh, when FBI Director Mueller and Attorney General John Ashcroft made this announcement yesterday about the terrorist threat? Were they talking most importantly to the American people, or were they somehow putting terrorists on notice that they were being watched and heard?
Well, you know, that's a good point. I mean, we talked to a guy named Bob Blitzer, who is the former counterterrorism chief for the FBI yesterday, as well as a guy from the CIA, and they both said that, in a sense, they probably are speaking to the terrorists by saying, look, we know where you're coming from, and we may know more than we're letting on in public. But I also think that it was mostly for the American public, and I have to say it was quite extraordinary seeing both Ashcroft and Mueller stand up on a podium and give this warning. The first time on October 11th, it was done through a news release, if I'm not mistaken. And this time they both got up together to say it, and Ashcroft actually canceled a trip to Toronto.
There has been talk that there's still the threat of sleeper cells of terrorists here in the United States, more than talk, almost the warning that they exist. What progress, if any, has been made in tracking them down?
Well, I know they're desperately searching for these people, and they say that they've got some leads. I think now there's more than 1,000 people in custody, and the FBI says that some of those people may be connected. But the thing you have to do is draw a distinction between the people connected with the September 11th attacks and other sleeper cells. They believe that out of all the people they have in custody, there's maybe a handful or less that have something to do with the September 11th attacks, but that does not mean that they don't have dozens or maybe even more people in custody that were terrorists planning some other attacks. Or that are just terrorists that weren't planning other attacks.
Have law enforcement institutions around the country taken steps today in the wake of this warning to heighten their alert level of alert and vigilance? Is there any higher that they could get?
Well, you know, that's an interesting point, too, because, you know, I talked to several of them last night and also some today, all of whom said that, they told us to go on a heightened state of alert much earlier. So we've done that, and there's really no other higher state of alert that we can go on now, but it's a reminder that we should continue to be vigilant. I mean, I know that they're doing patrols by power stations and water supplies and stadiums and so on. I mean, I can't even imagine the security tonight at the baseball playoff game.
Mm. Josh Meyer, thank you very much for joining us.
You're very welcome.
Josh Meyer covers the investigation for the Los Angeles Times. Eleven minutes after the State of Israel was created in 1948, the United States recognized the new country. Now, more than half a century has been invested in bonds of culture and economy, hard-nosed interests, and high ideals. It's always been a balancing act for U.S. governments, which prized Arab oil as much as Israeli friendship. But the friendship has survived wars and many presidencies. Now, what does history tell us about the way ahead as the United States enters a war on terror? Can this relationship be as close as ever? Will it change, for better or for worse? Joining us now from the studios of the Christian Science Monitor Radio in Washington, D.C., is Shlomo Avineri. From 1975 to 1977, he was director general of the Israeli Foreign Affairs Ministry under the first administration of Yitzhak Rabin. He teaches at Hebrew University in Jerusalem and currently is a visiting scholar at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace in Washington. Welcome and thank you for joining us, Shlomo Avineri.
Thank you.
Also with us is our special coverage news analyst, Jack Beatty. Welcome, Jack.
Welcome, Tom. Hi.
And you can join the conversation at 1-800-423-TALK. That's 1-800-423-8255. Shlomo Avineri, you've watched this relationship between the United States and Israel over many years now. Current events have led people in Israel and in the United States to wonder how much they can count on their ally for and have brought new kinds of pressures to bear on the relationship. But help us understand, first of all, how do you see the essence of this relationship? What is at the heart of it?
Well, it is a very unique relationship, as you said it yourself. And it is based on one hand on common ideals, but also on common realistic political considerations. This is very much different from the kind of relationship you had between the United States and Saudi Arabia, for example. There are obviously very important common interests between the United States and Saudi Arabia. Mm-hmm. You hardly can say that you really share any values. So when you look at the Israeli-American relationship, there are a number of layers there. I mean, first of all, Israel is the only democracy in the Middle East, a democracy with lots of problems, but it is the only democracy in the Middle East. So obviously there is an American feeling for this democracy. Secondly, there's a deep feeling among various American social, religious, ethnic groups for the Jews as the people of the book. There is the memory of the Holocaust. Mm. There is a similarity in culture. I mean, Israel is a combination of Middle Eastern, Mediterranean, European culture, but it is basically part of the Western world. And last and not least, there have been in the last 20, 25 years, deep strategic interests, which United States and Israel have in common. This wasn't so from the very beginning, but mm-hmm. it developed, let's say, in 1967, after the Six-Day War between Israel and the Arab states of Egypt and Syria, who at that time were supported by the Soviet Union, armed by the Soviet Union, strategically enjoying a Soviet umbrella. And from that moment on, it became very clear that if Israel is fighting Soviet allies or Soviet client states, there is a deep global strategic interest in the United States to see Israel prevail. So you have all those elements together, and they sometimes change from time to time. At the moment, obviously, there are deep strategic problems in this relationship because the United States is fighting a war against Egyptian and Saudi terrorists that happen to be Muslims. But it's not Islamic terrorism we're dealing here. We're dealing with terrorism originating in countries like Saudi Arabia and Egypt, terrorism that has deep roots in the social and economic conditions of those countries, which then find in religion the expression for the protest. And the United States obviously has to be very careful not to alienate, even more so than is already the case, Arab and Muslim countries.
Shlomo Avineri, walk us through, excuse me for interrupting, but walk us through, sure. if you would, how the strategic interests and relationship have changed beginning with the end of the Soviet Union, the end of the Soviet threat, and then through the 90s, and bring us up to date. Mm-hmm. How do you see those interests aligning or out of alignment between the U.S. and Israel right now?
Well, first of all, as I said, in the 60s and 70s, there was a very clear strategic community of interest between the United States and Israel when most of the militant Arab countries like Egypt, Syria, and Iraq were Soviet allies and clients. Now, this has changed in a way after the end of the Cold War, mm-hmm. but it changed in a very complex way because some of the radical Arab states lost the Soviet client, mm-hmm. Or the Soviet patron. Okay. Syria is still an anti-Western society. However, it doesn't have the military and strategic umbrella of the Soviet Union. So for the last 10 years, Israel, as well as the United States, felt basically comfortable in the Middle East. There were some anti-American as mm-hmm. well as anti-Israeli states, but they didn't have a global patron. With the emergence of radical fundamentalist Islam, which is an internal Arab protest movement, it's not first and foremost aimed against the United States. When you look at the history of somebody like Osama bin Laden, he is a person who is a protester against this very unusual regime, which is Saudi Arabia. For 20 years, the oil flowed out of Saudi Arabia, petrodollars were invested in the Western economy, and everybody was happy. But a lot of people overlook the fact that Saudi Arabia is a theocracy. Mm-hmm. It's a country into which non-Muslims are really not allowed, in which women cannot drive, never mind that there are no elections or civil rights or a free press. And the idea was that so long as the oil flows and everything is fine, nobody really cares about the internal structure of Saudi Arabia. However, there was local protest in Saudi Arabia. And because, on one hand, education in Saudi Arabia has been very religiously anti-Western, mm-hmm. very religiously anti-Christian, on the other hand, there were no political parties, no free press. The only way of channeling protest was into religious extremism. So the Saudis, and now the whole world, is reaping 20 or 30 years of a very oppressive, rich, but not equitable or just Saudi society.
And what does that mean for the United
States? Which has been exporting its internal mm-hmm. problems on the world scene.
We see that, but what does it mean for the United States and Israel that that's transpiring mm-hmm. in the context of this new war on terrorism? Do the strategic interests of these old allies still line up well?
Well, there is now obviously a fracture there, because obviously the strategic interests of the United States and Israel are the same. We have been victims of terrorism. You have been victims of terrorism. In both cases, mm-hmm. the terrorism comes from Arab extremists and Islamic fundamentalists. However, the United States needs at least a tacit support of large Arab countries, Saudi Arabia, Egypt. Nobody wants Saudi oil to fall into extremist hands. So you have to, the United States, you have to tread very carefully when it comes to Saudi Arabia. But on the other hand, the Saudi regime is very much constrained by its own internal weakness and its own structure from fully supporting the United States. Tom Friedman this mm-hmm. morning in the mm-hmm. New York Times had a very interesting piece in which he said it was very good for President Bush to come out and say, yes, we realize that Islam is a religion of peace and not a religion of war, because nobody wants a clash of religions. However, this is Tom Friedman continuing, the head of the Saudi royal family hasn't said something like this about Islam. So the Saudis are not exactly fair-weather friends, but they are you need their support, they need you. However, they are really allies with clay feet.
But Tom Friedman has also written that Israel's leaders may not fully understand how serious this war on terrorism is for America. Jack Beatty, what do you see in the shifting pressures on these two allies?
Well, I think Mr. Avenari outlined it pretty well. We have a need to show these Arab governments that progress, in their terms, is being made in the Palestinian-Israeli conflict. So as part of our coalition building, admittedly, this coalition has a kind of notional existence. Mm. They're not really doing very much mm-hmm. for us. But to keep alive to foreclose the possibility of criticism from this regime, we're assume, putting some sort of pressure on the Israelis to take more, I think the phrase is, risks for peace. Of course, on their part, they say, we've taken enough risks. I checked today, and according to the Israeli government, they've had 8,700 terrorist incidents in one sort or another just in the last year. That's a lot of risks for peace. Mm. And the question, I think, for Americans and for the relationship is, can progress be made just by leaving the parties there alone, or does it need, as Tony Lewis in today's Times was suggesting, quoting people both on the Israeli and Palestinian side, it is time for the United States to, quote, impose a settlement. Now, I don't know
that's a big word. Jack, we've got to take a break. That's a big word. We'll come back to it. Shlomo Avineri, hang on, please, and Jack Beatty will be right back. We're talking about the U.S.-Israeli relationship in the new pressure cooker of the war on terrorism. Does America pay too high a price today for its relationship with Israel? Or is this a time to embrace more than ever our old friend and ally? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-TALK. That's 1-800-423-8255. Or see a timeline tracking the history of this relationship at WBUR.org. Click on special coverage. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is WBUR Boston.
From Boston University, this is
WBUR in Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. We're talking this hour about the U.S.-Israel relationship in the context of an attack on the United States homeland and a new war on terrorism. After September 11th, should the United States pressure Israel to take more risks for peace? Does the U.S. have that right, or does it not? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Our guest this evening is Shlomo Avineri. He was Director General of Israel's Ministry of Foreign Affairs during the first administration of Yitzhak Rabin from 1975 to 1977. He teaches at the Hebrew University in Jerusalem and is currently a visiting scholar at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace in Washington. And we're joined by our own news analyst, Jack Beatty. Jack, I had to cut you off just before the break. I'm sorry for that, but you were bringing up Tony Lewis's point today that maybe it's time for the United States to impose a solution on Israel and Palestine. How does that fit into the context of this relationship? What's he suggesting?
Well, I don't really know, but he quotes people on both sides saying that we can't work it out ourselves. The Israelis feel they can't trust Arafat. He is not a partner for peace. On the other side, the Palestinians think that Mr. Sharon does not really believe in land for peace. So they're at loggerheads. And he seemed to be quoting people on both sides saying the United States needs to recognize this, step up to it, and do something. And I'm not sure what that something is. That's what I wanted Mr. Avineri to speculate on, if he would. What is it that these quoted these people, and there are some people formerly in government, there's some people who were in the academic world, what is it that they want the United States to do?
Shlomo Avineri?
Well, I don't know. I am not going to be a spokesman for people who are being quoted. But let's face it. And I think President Bush had said it. President Clinton said it before him. Secretary of State Colin Powell has said it. The United States cannot do more for peace than the local players. If the Israelis and the Palestinians cannot reach an agreement, and there was a serious attempt last year to reach an agreement with the President of the United States virtually not doing anything else for 3 or 4 more weeks, presiding over an Israeli-Palestinian conference, to no avail. So one can talk, we're talking very nice about the United States trying to do more. There should be peace. Let me tell you, I did not vote for Ariel Sharon in the last election. I don't hold any brief for him. But there are serious problems here. What do you mean by imposing peace? I mean, you may perhaps bring the both sides together, knock heads together, succeed more than Clinton did. And who's going to implement it? Who is going to chase away Palestinian terrorists who are shooting at a Jerusalem neighborhood like Gilo? The Israelis think that if they send tanks to Bethlehem, it's going to put an end to it. I'm not sure it works. But is there going to be an American force, a European force, a UN force doing it? So if there is no political will on both sides, and at the moment there is no political will, Arafat has decided after Camp David that he cannot achieve what he wants to achieve through negotiations, so he combines negotiations and terrorism, negotiation and terrorism. It's a good strategy from his point of view. It's not a strategy that Israel can basically accept, and it's not a strategy which is conducive to peace. What we can achieve, and here one has to be very positive but also very realistic, one can achieve a number of confidence-building steps. One can achieve a number of local agreements. One can achieve steps that will minimize friction and violence. And the United States is trying to do those things. You're not going to do it by rhetorics about imposed solution. You're not going to do it by rhetorics where, as President Bush said, there is a vision about the Palestinian state. I agree with him. I've been, as an Israeli, for the last 30 years for a Palestinian state living in peace next to Israel. But this is not the way to achieve an agreement when you just make those statements. You have to work on the ground. And on the ground, a lot of pragmatic things can be done. There has been a commission headed by former Senator George Mitchell, who suggested a time framework for a few months of confidence-building measures, of cessation of violence, of the Israelis stopping settlements, which the Israelis accepted, the Palestinians stopping violence, which they accepted at least verbally, but on the ground it's not happening. Those things can be achieved, but they cannot be achieved as a prize for terrorism.
Shlomo Avineri, we talked to George.
Let me just finish this one. with President Bush making the statement about the Palestinian state, with which I agree, and there's nothing new about it, but making that statement in the week in which you go to war on Afghanistan because of September 11th, it appeared that you are giving in to terrorism.
Do you think, Shlomo Avineri, that that is the message that Israel is reading from the United States now, that when the U.S. is looking, hoping for the situation to calm down between Israel and Palestine and the Palestinians, that Israel sees the U.S. Somehow being weak in the face of the Palestinian challenge?
Well, I wouldn't say weak, but making strategic decisions which appear to be playing into the hands of the terrorists. And some of it is a feeling you have in Israel. Certainly, this is a feeling that you have in the Arab world. Osama bin Laden can really say, okay, I did what I did, and look, the Americans are moving towards a more accommodating position on the Palestinian issue. Now, Osama bin Laden has never been a protagonist of Palestinian independence. This was never his agenda. His agenda was a Saudi Islamic agenda. But there is a question of appeasing terrorism, and it looked like this for many Arabs.
Shlomo Avineri, we have a lot of callers who want to join us here. Let us bring them in. We're talking about Israel and the United States and how their strategic interests may or may not align in this new period of war on terrorism. You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. Abraham is on the line. Welcome, Abraham. You're on the air.
How you doing?
We're well, thanks.
Good. Got a quick question. Why is it that America this time has entertained the notion of linkage? In other words, believing that by linking the Israeli-Palestinian question, they can actually build a coalition stronger than they did in the Gulf War.
Are you saying why are we talking about the U.S.-Israeli relationship in the context of the war on terrorism?
Well, no, not necessarily. In the Gulf War, they kind of dislinked the Arab-Palestinian question from the coalition building itself.
And tried to sideline Israel.
Correct. Well, tried to sideline that whole issue so it didn't become a problem.
Well, it's a good question. Maybe it's too hot to be sidelined right now. Jack Beatty?
Well, yeah. Of course, the administration was at pains to say that the announcement that President Bush made about the Palestinian states had been in the works before September 11th. So we don't really know, and we can take them at their word. But, of course, this would look – I suppose this does look like a concession. But we're just in a bind here. Our homeland has just been attacked by these madmen and murderers, and we're in an effort to try to go after them, minimizing the collateral damage in the Muslim world. One way of doing that is by showing that we are willing to put as much pressure as possible – I don't know what that means – on the whole idea of a Middle Eastern – in other words, we have to show we're serious about it. President Bush hadn't up until September 11th. This was on the back burner of the administration. They were letting things drift. And all the momentum that had built up after Camp David just had dissipated in a year of terrorism. But we it's almost sort of incumbent upon us to try to show that we are stepping up to this issue in some way. That is to say, saying to both sides – this is the time. We need some progress here to help us. After all, you know, our government gave – the Senate last week approved 96-2 a $2 billion in military aid for Israel and a $720 million in economic aid. That's our commitment to Israel. But that does give us a certain right to say to Israel, well, here's our problem. How can you help us? How can we help you? I mean, I just don't think we can – these things are linked. They've been linked by the necessities of our coalition.
Jack Shlomo Avineri, I want to
– May I just add a word here?
Yes,
since,
please.
Money was mentioned. The United States gives every year $2.2 billion in aid to Egypt as well as to Israel. What is United States getting in return from Egypt? This is a legitimate question. Now, if you look at what it appears in the Egyptian press, which is more or less government-controlled, is violently anti-American, not just because United States supports Israel, because United States is capitalist, it's imperialist, it's materialist. It's coming from the extreme left in Egypt and from the fundamentalist rights. All the preachers in Islamic mosques in Egypt, who are government employees every Friday fulminate against, not only Israel, that's okay, we can live with that, but against the United States and Christianity and the new Crusaders, etc. You are giving $2.2 billion a year to Egypt. Now, this is very important. I'm for the continuation of this aid, because this aid helped Egypt sustain the peace with Israel, which is very, very important.
We have the sense right now that we're paying that money to keep the lid on Egyptian society.
Okay, that's fine, but this really raises a fundamental question. And again, I think the United States should do more about the Middle East peace, but it should be realistic. It should not do again what President Clinton did, because if you aim too high, you fall flat on your face. And you have to ask a fundamental question, which the Egyptians and the Saudis and the Jordanians don't really ask, and therefore they're focusing on the Israeli-Palestinian issue. Can you have peace in the Middle East without democratization in countries like Egypt and Saudi Arabia and without wealth sharing in the Arab world?
Shlomo Avineri, you raise a big issue there. I want to bring one more voice into our conversation right now. We're joined by Stephen Spiegel. He teaches political science at UCLA and is author of The Other Arab-Israeli Conflict, Making America's Middle East Policy from Truman to Reagan. Good evening, Stephen Spiegel.
How are you?
We're well, thanks, and thanks for joining us. I'm sure you've caught a little bit of what we're into here. We're talking about the U.S.-Israel relationship in the context of this new war on terror and what the United States can fairly or not fairly ask of Israel right now. Anthony Lewis wrote in the New York Times today that perhaps it's even time for the United States to impose a peace settlement on Israel and the Palestinians. Is that a realistic idea? Is that something that's come out of the pressure cooker of these new circumstances?
Well, first of all, I think that the mistake that the United States has been making since September 11th, we've got a very difficult linkage problem, and the way we get around that is that we should be embracing Israel in terms of our strategic relationship with Israel. I noticed that Logan Airport has just hired an Israeli official to help with their security. We'll be doing more of that, and then I think the Israelis would feel more secure in terms of their relationship with us.
Why do you think we haven't been doing that, Stephen Spiegel?
I think we haven't been doing it because, first of all, it's a new administration. It's preoccupied with many other issues. It's a very subtle point that you learn from experience.
But we've been looking for allies all over the world lately.
We've been looking for allies all over the world, but we have a problem with India and Israel because we're concerned about Pakistan and the Arabs. We've been treating the Indians very similarly to the Israelis, and the way around that is to embrace both of them because they have both been victims of terrorism and they have something to teach us. And if you ask about the question of imposing a peace on the Middle East, a lot of people are so frustrated with this issue, and I think we would have had some of this even without September 11th because the administration, as was pointed out earlier, was moving on this issue. But the effort, if you want to impose a peace, you have to have a plan. We do have the Clinton plan. And secondly, you've got to put an enormous effort into it. And one wonders if the administration has the capacity, given the problems it has at home because of anthrax, Homeland Security, and because of the international arena. You've got to, because if you try to impose a peace, you've got to get the two sides to support you, and you have to sustain it, even if you can pull off an agreement. That's why, in some ways, most people who want more greater American activism, not because of September 11th, not because to assuage the Arabs, but because peace in itself is a good, and it's good for Israel, it's good for the Arabs, it's good for the United States.
Stephen Spiegel, you're suggesting that the United States should actually embrace Israel more warmly in the aftermath of 9/11, but it would appear that the calculus in Washington is the opposite, that they need some distance to bring Arab and Islamic states into the anti-terrorism coalition, does it not?
Well, I think the calculation in Washington is that Israel cannot really be part of the coalition if the Arabs are going to be joined. I'm talking about a sideshow, which is very different. You can have your cake and eat it, too, if you pursued what I was suggesting.
Shlomo Avineri, do you share this sense that the United States is mistakenly keeping a distance from Israel since September 11th?
I wouldn't call it a mistake, but I think it's a question of strategic assessment. And one of the questions that has to be raised is, can Saudi Arabia remain, after this war is over, or throughout the war, the country in which it has been? I mean, can you have peace and quiet in the Middle East beyond the Arab-Israeli conflict. After all, in the last 50 years, more Arabs were killed by Arabs in inter- and intra-Arab wars than in Arab-Israeli wars. And can you do it while you have, on one hand, extreme wealth in Saudi Arabia and extreme poverty in a country of 70 million people like Egypt, which tries to reach out to the West but cannot do it? An Egyptian friend has said to me a few years ago, imagine that the Saudis would be ready to invest in Egypt one quarter of what they're investing on the Western Stock Exchange and invest it, not give it us to a charity. Saudi wealth, Egyptian manpower, 70 million people, we could become the South Korea or Japan of the Middle East.
But we're looking at the U.S. and Israel, and I want to ask Stephen Spiegel, we've just got him for another minute, where do you see this relationship headed, Stephen Spiegel? How do the strategic interests line up right now, and is the fundamental relationship strong enough to weather the new tensions?
Absolutely. I think that in the 90s we didn't have a lot of pressure and strain between the United States and Israel. We got used to a much higher level of camaraderie than we traditionally had. I think in many ways we've returned to the norm of some tensions in the U.S.-Israeli relationship that we had before the Clinton administration. I think we can do active diplomacy and also a close U.S.-Israeli relationship. We can do both.
Stephen Spiegel, thanks very much for joining us. Stephen Spiegel joined us from UCLA, where he's a political science professor. Thanks a lot for being with us.
Sure.
Let's get one quick call before the break. Herb is on the line. Welcome, Herb.
Hi. Good evening. This is a great discussion. I guess I'm sort of interested in Shlomo Avineri's take on sort of internal Israeli political and military situation. One thing is, in the last week or so, we've seen Israeli army invade several towns in the West Bank and hold them. And daily, the United States administration was calling on the Israeli troops to withdraw.
Herb, our time's running down. Give us your question.
I guess I'm just wondering, what does Shlomo Avineri think? How effective is U.S. pressure on Ariel Sharon, or is he really as independent as he makes out to be among the Israeli public?
Thanks, Herb, very much. Shlomo Avineri, we just got a minute.
Neither nor. Israel withdrew from Bethlehem because there was an agreement under American pressure between the Israelis and the Palestinians about a local ceasefire agreement in this region, in this area. This is what American pressure can achieve. It was pressuring the Israelis. It was pressuring the Palestinians. It was in both sides' interest to do it. This is very positive. This can be done. But something beyond this, I do not imagine is feasible at the moment.
Jack Bedian, what do you think of Washington must be thinking about Ariel Sharon and his responsiveness right now?
Well, yeah, they got something out of that encounter. There was a quotation today from the former official in the Mossad who was saying, you know, this movement into Bethlehem and so on, done for immediate reasons. He said, of course, this is going to make more recruits for our enemies. And this is the cycle that people talk about when they say that something beyond what we're talking about, more like an imposed peace, needs to take place, because this cycle just continues. The cycle of the suicide bombers, the cycle of the Israeli retaliation, which creates more recruits for the suicide bombers.
A cycle that we don't want to enter ourselves.
No. No.
We're talking about U.S.-Israel relations in the pressure cooker of the new war on terrorism. You can join the conversation by calling 1-800-423-TALK. That's 1-800-423-8255. Or jump into the conversation online, log on to our website at WBUR.org, and click on Special Coverage Forums. I'm Tom Ashbrook. You're listening to Special Coverage from WBUR Boston.
From Boston University,
that's from WBUR Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about the U.S.-Israel relationship, a long history, not always easy, but deep roots. What is the present and future for this relationship in the context of the new war on terror? We're joined this evening by Shlomo Avineri. He's former Director General of Israel's Ministry of Foreign Affairs, and by our own news analyst, Jack Beatty. You can join the conversation as well at 1-800-423-8255. Michael is on the line. Welcome, Michael. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks. Another great conversation tonight.
Good.
I have two kind of questions and points. What kind of pressure is the United States putting on Israel to implement at least some of the Mitchell recommendations? And what I mean is, in my estimation, I think that we ought to be putting some pressure on Israel to accept peacekeeping forces, because it seems that every single time a gun goes off in the Middle East, or at least in Israel, you know, the Palestinians say the Israelis shot first, the Israelis say the Palestinians shot first, and neither one of them, truthfully, can be trusted 100%. That's number one. And number two, what is the what's the prognosis on lifting sanctions on Iraq with some caveats to Saddam Hussein, that if he invades a neighbor, you know, the full wrath of the United States will be brought back upon him, in other words, an invasion?
Michael, you're extending our buffet even wider tonight, but let's take those on. Shlomo Avineri, what about U.S. pressure on Israel? Is it, you've watched this relationship over a long period. Is it as high now as you've ever seen it or not? And what about the notion of bringing some kind of peacekeeping troops into the Israeli-Palestinian standoff?
Peacekeeping troops are helpful when there is a peace to keep. There is no peace at the moment. Do you expect American troops to be stationed on the hills around Jerusalem, tracing Palestinian terrorists, or perhaps then shooting at Israeli tanks? This is really not realistic. You have, first of all, to de-escalate the violence, and this can be done if it will be in the interest on both sides. And I'm glad this, Michael, I think, mentioned the Mitchell Report. The Mitchell Report talks primarily, and this is the first step, and if you look at it very carefully, you see it's a very sophisticated plan for de-escalation of violence. The first thing is you have to have a cooling-off period. Over the last year, Arafat again and again committed himself to do it. He did not do it. In 1993, and not far away from where I'm sitting now, on the White House lawn, Arafat signed on the dotted line that whatever the disagreements in the future will be, he's not going to have recourse to violence. Now he's using violence in a very sophisticated and nuanced way of one as a means of negotiations. So we have, yes, we have to move away from the confrontation. But bringing in peacekeepers, United Nations forces, or NATO forces, American forces, that's not what we need.
But Shlomo Avineri, you can hear the frustration that leads to that suggestion. The idea, I mean, the Israelis and Palestinians simply seem incapable of achieving this peace.
Okay, we are very frustrated, and therefore one has to be realistic. You see, I supported the Oslo Peace Treaty. I hope that this was will be the road for historical compromise. We saw many of us on the Israeli left. So Arafat is moving towards reconciliation. Arafat is not yet ready for reconciliation. So if we're not ready for reconciliation, let's have an armistice. Let's have an effective ceasefire, like in many other places, like in, if you wish, in Kosovo, in Macedonia, in Bosnia, where there is no way of imposing a solution. There is no way of keeping a peace where there is no peace. The frustration is really very deep among Israelis. Let me tell you, before I walked into this studio, I read a report from Israel that on the road leading to my university in Jerusalem, a car was hit by Palestinian terrorists. There is deep frustration about the inability or unwillingness on the Palestinian side to really reconcile themselves to the existence of Israel and living in peace with it. If it is not possible to achieve peace, let's achieve something like in Cyprus, where you have a non-solution of two entities living side by side, not in peace, not in harmony, but not in daily conflict.
Wouldn't that require some kind of monitoring or peacekeeping?
Well, first of all, it would require some agreement. And at the moment, the agreement is elusive. It is elusive because one side, the Palestinian side, and I'm saying it as somebody who for the last 30 years has advocated negotiating with Arafat when it was very, very unpopular in Israel and even illegal to meet with Palestinians, as I did. I didn't care that it was illegal as far as the Israeli law was concerned, because I thought this was the right way. The tragedy is that we do not have a partner on the other side, and one has to realize it.
Let's come to another caller. Dennis is on the line from Providence, Rhode Island. Welcome, Dennis. You're on the line.
Yes, thanks for taking my call. I'm glad that the guest from Israel is mentioning reality, because the reality that the American people must understand, it's very unfortunate that we have this reality, but the reality is, as long as we have troops in Saudi Arabia, And as long as we support Israel like a 51st state, we are going to have gigantic problems from people who came over from the Middle East who are currently in this country. We are going to have gigantic problems.
So what do you think the solution is, Dennis? What's the solution?
If you read the New York Times on the front cover of the New York Times almost 2 years ago, you would see people dancing in what looks like a Western disco. It wasn't. The title underneath it was Dreaming of America. These young people in Israel want to come to America. I say invite them.
Well, they also want to have a homeland that's safe, I guess, and defended. Jack Beatty, you hear in Dennis's call.
May I say what?
Shlomo Avineri.
May I say what? Mm-hmm. Okay, may I say what?
Please.
There are Saudi troops, the American troops in Saudi Arabia, and I realize that there is Saudi sensitivity to this and respect it. But there are Saudi troops, there are American troops in Saudi Arabia, not because the United States is occupying Saudi Arabia, but because the Saudi regime wants those American troops in order to bolster up its regime. Now, perhaps something has to be done about the Saudi regime. Perhaps it should open up. Perhaps it should democratize. Perhaps it should bring in women into something like driving cars. Perhaps it should share its wealth with the surrounding Arab countries. This is a very serious problem. But the reason there are American troops in Saudi Arabia is because the Saudis want it. So one shouldn't really obfuscate the issue by appearing as if this is an American occupation of Saudi Arabia. This is not the case.
And no one sees that going on. Bill is on the line. Welcome, Bill. You're on the air.
Hi, thanks.
Sure.
Yeah, really quick question. With the beginning of the conversation, you're talking about the relationship we had with Israel vis-a-vis the Cold War, and the Cold War ended, and it seems to be our relationship has gone from an ideological one to purely an economic one, where our interests are primarily in oil, so over in the Middle East. So how does that change our relationship with Israel? Your guest did not answer that question, and I think it's a critical one.
Are you saying that Israel doesn't have oil, so we shouldn't have a relationship?
No, I'm not saying that. I'm saying that our relationship seems to, at least with the entire Middle East, seems to be more economic, whereas before our relationship specifically mm-hmm. with Israel was mm-hmm. ideological, mm-hmm. As we were both opposed to communism.
We got it. Let's put it to Shlomo Avineri. Bill's pointing out that in the post-Cold War period, you do see, as you referred to earlier, this drift toward more economic interest above ideological. How does that create a new situation for the U.S. and Israel?
Well, the oil dependence or the American dependence on Middle East and basically Saudi and Kuwaiti oil was there also at the height of the Cold War in 1973.
But now it's not so tinged with the Soviet threat around.
Excuse me. There was an Arab oil embargo against the West, mm-hmm. headed by Saudi Arabia. Let's not forget it. It was perhaps not so tense, but it was in the middle of the Cold War. So oil has always been an ingredient and will remain an ingredient. The question is, how do you best defend the global interest in Middle Eastern oil? Do you defend them in the best way by supporting an oppressive, theocratic, anti-Western, intolerant, oligarchic regime like the Saudi regime? For 20 years, it appeared this is the case. But the chicken have come home to roost. Just as the Soviet Union has imploded, let me say very gently that I'm not sure Saudi Arabia is going to come out of this war intact, and one should very seriously think not about post-Taliban arrangement in Afghanistan. Policymakers in Washington, all over the world, should very carefully calibrate the policies, what is going to happen in Saudi Arabia, because this regime is not stable. It is destabilizing the area, and one has to address those issues. Those are very serious issues for which I do not have an answer, but they were not addressed for 20 years.
Shlomo Avineri, thank you so much for joining us this evening.
Thank you.
Shlomo Avineri is former Director General of Israel's Ministry of Foreign Affairs. He's currently a visiting scholar at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace in Washington. Jack Beatty, this conversation is clearly going to go on and on. No easy bottom line here. A long relationship, a great ally, and yet such difficult circumstances surrounding the relationship now.
Difficult for the United States. We're not just bystanders now. We're not just sort of kibitzing on Middle East peace. It's important to us for for strategic purposes. I wanted to go back to something someone mentioned. I think it was Dennis. He was talking about, you know, linking the Palestinian issue with bin Laden. And in other words, this is one of his complaints. The Palestinians themselves have delinked that. They said before the assassination of the Israeli cabinet member that, look, don't put our cause in, don't embrace our cause. It's apart from you. You're tarnishing it. And I think that's an important point to make. In other words, we can't just set our policy on appeasing this madman and say that'll make us safe. It won't.
And yet there seems that maybe there's some kind of move to put new pressure to take things in a new direction here from the talk in the wind.
Well, we heard from Senator Mitchell last week, and he said he spoke recently with both Mr. Sharon and Mr. Arafat, and both of them, in practically the same words, said this war is unbearable for our people. And one can only hope that that feeling of war weariness can somehow get the parties together.
Jack, thanks very much for being with us tonight.
Thank you.
You can read a timeline tracking the history of U.S.-Israeli relations. Log on to our website at www.wbur.org and click on Special Coverage. Now, looking for peace of mind on the pharmacy shelves. Michelle Oreklin is a staff writer for Time magazine. She tells the story of how a case of the sniffles became a cause for panic.
I have betrayed my civic duty. Despite the urging of the medical community and government officials, I have hoarded Cipro. I have rationalized my behavior by the fact that I work in the media, even though neither I nor anyone else at my office at Time have opened a suspicious envelope. I am not by nature a hypochondriac. I don't contract whatever disease happens to be trumpeted on that day's local news. But if ever there was a time to over-identify with what I saw on TV, I found it on October 12th. On that Friday, I was sitting in my office watching CNN and nursing flu-like symptoms, which I imagined signified nothing more than the flu. But then CNN cut to a news conference at NBC, one block away. NBC's president reported that an employee had tested positive for anthrax after first exhibiting flu-like symptoms. So I immediately called my doctor. "You don't have anthrax poisoning," she reassured me, attempting to impress upon her the difference between myself and her other patients who had undoubtedly called that day. I coughed dramatically and insisted, "But I work for a major media outlet." "It sounds like you have a flu," she said, "and if it doesn't get better by next week, come in and we'll give you something to treat it." I then called a friend who, though not an expert in germ warfare, was nevertheless an MD, and convinced him to prescribe Cipro, which I promised I would only take should I begin to exhibit festering boils. My pharmacy, a half a block away, is also the closest pharmacy to NBC, so I worried when I went to pick up my prescription that all Cipro supplies would be depleted. They were not, but brisk traffic in the drug had obviously been taking place that day. The cashier, not the pharmacist, mind you, but the cashier, looked at my bottle, raised an eyebrow, surveyed me in what I maintained was a condescending manner, and said, "Huh, only 250 milligrams. How much is everyone else getting?" I asked. 500, she told me. "Well, I'll just take two," I reasoned out loud. "But you only have a total of 10, and you need enough for 60 days. I slinked off, feeling like I had been caught wearing fake designer jeans on the first day of school when everyone else had the real thing. In the days immediately following, people at the office maintained a remarkable calm. There were reports in local papers of a newly coined term, anthrax envy, a condition that takes hold when members of competing news organizations or Senate offices are found to have tested positive. Unfortunately, more and more did. ABC, then CBS, then the New York Post. I had to imagine that if the New York Post was a target, then so is the nation's preeminent news magazine. Though I doubted anyone would single me out, I figured somewhere in the building was a suspicious letter. Then, as postal workers in Washington, D.C. began dying, and anthrax no longer seemed as treatable as the hiccups, we stopped receiving any outside mail. In recent days, we have been led in groups around the office to learn where our fire exits are, what to do in the case of a bomb threat. We get daily email updates on precautions being taken and assurances that our mailroom has tested negative. I don't really miss my mail. Most of the letters I got were press releases about the latest clothing line of minor movie stars or the new offerings at the most celebrated steakhouse in Miami. But I do miss the ritual of retrieving it. It's a ritual formed in childhood when mail meant birthday party invitations or checks from grandparents, when it didn't yet mean bills or credit card solicitations, and it certainly didn't mean anthrax.
Michelle Oreklin lives in New York City. She's a staff writer for Time magazine. Over the next few weeks, you'll be hearing more radio diaries from around the country. We'd like to hear from you. Send your submissions by email. The address is special at wbur.org.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. You're listening to special coverage from WBUR in Boston.
This is WBUR. We're funded by you, our listeners.